impounded. More pictures, faces, men, shooting, fire, horrid fire reduced to a tiny flash of black and white in my hands. Then the bright face of the newswoman, and a change of tone, as she looked directly in the eyes of the camera and into mine. Who was Gregory Belkin? Were there, in fact, twin brothers, Nathan and Gregory, as those closest to the Mogul cult leader suspect? Two bodies remain, one buried in the Jewish cemetery, the other in the Manhattan morgue. And though the remnants of the Hasidic community in Brooklyn, founded by Belkin's grandfather, refused to talk to authorities, the coroner's office continues to investigate the two men. The woman's face vanished. Azrael appeared. A photograph of him, coarse and remote, but unmistakable. Meantime, the man accused of the murder of Rachel Belkin, the man who might in fact be deeply involved in the entire conspiracy, is still at large. Then came a series of still pictures, obviously gleaned from video surveillance cameras. Azrael, beardless and without his mustache, walking through the lobby of a building. Azrael in the crowd crying out over the body of Esther Belkin. Azrael in close-up, beardless without his mustache, staring directly in front of him as he went through a door. There was a string of shots, almost too blurry to mean anything, obviously taken from other surveillance cameras, including one of the beardless Azrael walking with Rachel Belkin herself, mother of Esther, wife of Gregory, or so the commentator informed me. Of Rachel, all I saw was a slender body, impossibly high heel shoes, and mussed hair. But there was Azrael, no doubt. I was enthralled. The face of a bald male official, also suffering in freezing weather, probably that of Washington, D.C., appeared suddenly with the reassuring assertion. There is no reason at all to fear the temple or its grandiose schemes. Every single location has been either raided by police, burned during the raid by its own members, or thoroughly cleared with all members under lock and key. As for the mysterious man, we have no eyewitnesses to him at all after the night of Rachel Belkin's death, and he may very well have perished in the New York Temple, along with hundreds of others during the fire that lasted a full 24 hours before police could get it under control. Another man, even more authoritarian and perhaps angry, took the microphone. The temple is neutralized. The temple has been stopped. Even as we speak, banking connections are being investigated, and arrests have already been made in the financial communities of Paris, London, and New York. There was a crash of static, of glittering white lights on the little screen. I shook the tiny television. The voice talked again, but this time it was about a terrorist bomb in South America, about drug lords, about trade sanctions against Japan. I put down the little thing. I turned it off. I might have cruised a while for another channel, but I had had enough. I coughed a couple of times, caught off guard by how deep the cough sounded and by how much it hurt me, and then I tried to remember. Rachel Belkin. Rachel Belkin murdered. That had happened only days after Esther Belkin. Rachel Belkin in Miami, murdered. Twins. I remembered the picture Azrael had shown to me. The Hasid with the beard and locks and the silk hat. From some giant filing system in my mind, it came to me that Rachel Belkin had been the socialite wife of Gregory, a conspicuous critic of his temple. And the only time I had even noticed the woman's name, reputation or existence, is when I'd caught a fragment of the funeral of Esther. And the cameras had followed her mother to a black car, voices clamoring for her opinions. Had Belkin's enemies killed her daughter? Was it a Middle Eastern terrorist plot? A wave of dizziness came over me. It threatened to get worse. I put down the television and went back to the bed. I lay down. I was tired and thirsty. I covered up, then sat up enough to drink more of the water. I drank it and drank it and drank it and then lay back, and I thought. What seemed real was not the television set and its cryptic reports. What seemed real was this room, and the way the fire danced, and that he had been here. And what seemed real was the image of the cauldron filled with boiling liquid, and the unspeakable, unimaginable idea of being cast into such a thing. Cast into boiling liquid. I closed my eyes. Then I heard him singing again. By the rivers of Babylon there we sat down. Yea, we wept when we remembered Zion. I heard myself singing it. Come back, Azrael. Come back. Tell me what else happened, I said, and then I slept. The sound of the door opening woke me. It was completely dark outside now, and it was deliciously warm in the room. All the chill was gone out of my bones. I saw a figure standing by the hearth looking down at the flames. I let out a little cry before I could catch myself. Not exactly manly or courageous. But a steam rose from the figure, or a mist, and the figure appeared to be Gregory Belkin, to have that man's head, at least, and hair, and then to be shifting back into the massive curls of Azrael, and Azrael's scowl. Another attempt was made. A putrid smell filled the room, as foul as the smell in a morgue. Then it grew faint. Azrael, restored to himself, was there, with his back to me. He spread out his arms, and he said something that was probably Sumerian, but I don't know. He called for something, and the something was a sweet fragrance. I blinked. I could see rose petals in the air. I felt them fall on my face. The morgue smell was gone. Before the fire, he stretched out his arms again, and he changed. It was a pale image of Gregory Belkin. It flickered, and at once his own form swallowed it. And he let down his arms with a sigh. I climbed out of bed and went to the tape recorder. "May I turn it on?" I said. I looked up and saw him in the full light of the fire now, and I realized he was wearing a suit of blue velvet trimmed in an old gold motif around the collar, the ends of the sleeves and the pant legs. He wore a thick belt of the same color embroidered in gold, and his face looked slightly older than it had before. I stood up and came close to him as politely as I could. What had changed, precisely? Well, his skin was slightly darker, like that of a man who lived in the sun, and his eyes definitely bore more detail, the lids having softened and become less than perfect, and, perhaps, more beautiful. I could see the pores of his skin and the small random hairs, dark, fine, at the edges of his hair. "What do you see?" he asked. I sat down near to the tape recorder. "Everything is a little bit darker and more detailed," I said. He nodded. "I can no longer summon the shape of Gregory Belkin at will. As for the semblance of anyone else, I cannot hold it very long. I am not a scientist enough to understand it. Some day it will be understood. It will have to do with particles and vibration. It will have to do with things mundane." I was in a fury of curiosity. "Have you tried to take any other form? The form of someone you like, perhaps a little more than Gregory Belkin?" He shook his head. "I can make myself ugly if I want to frighten you, but I don't want to be ugly. I don't want to frighten anyone. Hate has abandoned me, and it's taken some power with it, I imagine. I can work tricks. Watch this." He put his hands up round his neck, and slowly drew them down the embroidered front of his coat, revealing as he did a necklace of engraved gold discs, like ancient coins. The entire house rattled. The fire flared for an instant, and then became smaller. He picked up the necklace to demonstrate the solidity and the weight of it, and then he let it drop. "You have a fear of animals?" he asked me. "A distaste for wearing their skins? I see no skins here, warm skins like bear skins." "No fear at all," I said. "No distaste. The temperature of the room rose dramatically, and once again the fire exploded as if someone had fanned it, and I felt myself surrounded by a large, dark, bearskin blanket, lined in silk. I put my hand up and felt the fur. It was deep and luxurious, and made me think of Russian woods, and men in Russian novels who are always dressed in fur. I thought of Jews who used to wear fur hats in Russia, and maybe still do. I sat up, adjusting the blanket more comfortably around me. "That's quite wonderful," I said. I was trembling. So many thoughts were racing in me that I couldn't think what to say first. He gave a deep sigh and rather dramatically collapsed in his chair. "This has exhausted you," I said. "The changes, the tricks." "Yes, somewhat. But I'm not exhausted for talking, Jonathan. It's that I can only do so much and no more. But then, who knows? What is God doing to me? I just thought that this time, after this ordeal was completed, you know, that the stairway would come. Or there would be deep sleep. I thought so many things, and wanted to finish." He paused. "I've learnt something," he said. "I've learnt in these last 2 days that to tell a story is not what I thought." "Explain to me." "I thought to talk about the boiling cauldron would send the pain out of me. It didn't. Unable to hate, to muster anger, I feel despair." He paused. "I want you to tell me the whole story. You do believe in it. That's why you came, to tell it all." "Well, let's say that I will finish, because someone should know. Someone should record. And out of courtesy for you, because you are gracious and you listen, and I think you want to know."
"I do."
"But I must tell you how difficult it was to imagine such cruelty, to imagine that your own father gave you up to it, and to imagine a death so contrived. Do you still forgive your father?" "Not at the moment," he said. "That's what I was talking about. But telling it did not produce forgiveness. It drew me close to him, to tell it, to see him. He wasn't as strong as you. On that he was right." A silence fell between us. I thought of Rachel Belkin, the murder of Rachel Belkin, but I said nothing. "Did you like walking in the snow?" I asked. He turned to me in surprise and smiled. It was very bright and kind. "Yes, I did. But you haven't eaten your supper, which I warmed for you. No, sit there, I'll get it, and one of your silver spoons." He was as good as his word. I ate a bowl of the stew as he watched with his arms folded. I put aside the empty plate, and at once he took it, and then the spoon. I heard the sound of water running as he washed them. He brought back to me a small, clean bowl of water and a towel, as someone might have done in another country. I didn't need it, but I dipped my fingers, and I used the cloth to wipe my mouth clean, which felt rather comforting, and he took these things away. It was now that he saw the little boat television set with its built-in handle and tiny screen. I'd probably left it too near the fire. I felt a surge of embarrassment, as though I had spied upon his world while he was gone, as if to verify things he said. He looked at the thing for a long moment, and then away. "It works? It talked to you?" he asked without enthusiasm. "News from some local town. Network, I think, coming through the local channel. The Belkin temples have been raided, people arrested. The public is being reassured." He waited a long time before he answered. Then he said, "Yes, well, there are some others, perhaps, that they haven't found yet, but the people in them are dead. When you come upon these men with their gun belts and their vow to kill themselves along with the entire population of a country, it's best to kill them on the spot." They showed your face, I said. Smooth-shaven. He laughed. Which means they'll never find me under all this hair. Especially not if you cut the long part, but that would be rather a shame. I don't need to, he said. I can still do the most important thing of all.
Which is what?
Disappear. Ah, I'm glad to hear it.
Do you know they are looking for you? They said something about the murder of Rachel Belkin. I hardly know the name.
He seemed neither surprised, nor insulted, nor upset in any way. She was Esther's mother. She didn't want to die in Gregory's house.
But I'll tell you the strange part.
When he looked at her dead body, I think he was grief-stricken. I think he actually loved her. We forget that such men can love.
Do you want to tell me whether or not you killed her? Or is that something I shouldn't ask?
I didn't kill her, he said simply. They know that. They were there. That was early. Why would they bother to look for me any more?
It's all to do with conspiracy and banks and plots and the long tentacles of the temple.
You're a man of mystery.
Ah, yes.
And, as I said, I am one who can, if necessary, disappear.
Go to the bones? I asked.
Ah, the bones. The golden bones.
You ready to tell me?
I'm thinking how to do it. There's a little more that I should tell before I come to the moment of Esther Belkin's death. There were masters I did love. I should explain a little more.
You won't tell me about all of them?
Too many, he said. And some are not worth remembering, and some I can't remember at all. There are two I want to describe to you. The first and the last master whom I ever obeyed. I stopped obedience to any master. I slew when called, not only the man who had called me or the woman, but everyone who had witnessed the calling. I did that for years and years. And then the bones were encased with warnings in Hebrew and German and Polish, and no one took the risk to call the servant of the bones. But I want to tell you about the two, the first and the last masters I obeyed. The others which I do recall we can dismiss with a few words.
You look more cheerful now, more rested, I said.
I do?
He laughed.
How is that? Ah, well, I did sleep, and I am strong, very strong, there's no doubt of it. And the story has a way of calling me back. He sighed. I don't know much life in death without pain, he said. But that I deserve, I imagine, being a demon of might. The last master I obeyed was a Jew in the city of Strasbourg, and they burned all the Jews there because they blamed them for the Black Death.
Ah, I said, that must have been the 14th century.
The year 1349 of the current era, he said with a smile. I looked it up. They killed the Jews then all over Europe, blaming them for the Black Death.
I know.
Yes, and there have been many Holocausts since. Do you know what Gregory told me? Our beloved Gregory Belkin? When he thought he was my master and that I would help him?
I can't guess.
He told me that if the Black Death had not come to Europe, Europe would be a desert today. He said that the population had grown rampant, that the trees were being cut down so fast that the entire forests of old Europe were gone by that time. And the forests of Europe we know now date back to the 14th century.
That's true, I said. I think.
Is that how he justified the murder of people? Oh, that was one of just many ways. Gregory was an extraordinary man, really. Because he was an honest man.
Not mad? To found this worldwide temple and fill it with terrorists?
No, he shook his head. Just ruthless and honest. He said to me at one point,
that there was one man who had utterly changed the history of the world. I thought he would say that that man was Christ or Cyrus the Persian, or perhaps Mohammed. But he said no. The man who changed the entire world was Alexander the Great. That was his model. Gregory was perfectly sane. He intended to break a giant Gordian knot. He almost succeeded. Almost. How did you stop him? How did it all come about? A fatal flaw in him stopped him, he said. Do you know, in the old Persian religion, one legend is that evil came into the world not through sin or through God, but through a mistake, a ritual mistake. I've heard of it. You're talking of very old myths, fragments of Zoroastrianism. Yes, he said. Myths the Medians gave to the Persians and the Persians passed on to the Jews. Not disobedience. Bad judgment. It's almost that way in Genesis, wouldn't you say? Eve makes a mistake in judgment. A ritual rule is broken. That must be different from sin, don't you think? I don't know. If I knew that, I would be a happier man. He laughed. What undid Gregory was a flaw in judgment, he said. How? He counted on my vanity being as great as his. Or maybe he just misjudged my power, my willingness to intervene. No, he thought I would be swept up with his notions. He thought they were irresistible. It was an error in judgment. Had he not told me things, key things right at the appropriate moment, even I could not have stopped his plan. But he had to tell, to boast, to be recognized by me, and to be loved. I think even be loved by me. Did he know what you were? The servant of the bones? A spirit? Oh, yes. We came together without any question of credibility, as you would say today. But I'll get to that. He sat back. I checked the tape recorders. I removed the small cassettes and replaced them with fresh cassettes, and then made markings on the labels so that I wouldn't confuse myself. I laid both machines back on the hearth. He was watching me with keen interest and an agreeable look. Yet he seemed reluctant to begin, or to be finding it difficult, yet yearning to do it. "Did Cyrus the Persian keep his word to you?" I asked. I had been thinking of this on and off since we'd broken off. "Did he actually send you to Miletus? I find it hard to believe that Cyrus the Persian would keep his word." "You do?" He looked at me and smiled. "But he kept his word to Israel, as you know. The Jews were allowed to leave Babylon, and they went home, and they made the kingdom once again of Judea, and they built the Temple of Solomon. You know all this from history. Cyrus kept his word to his conquered peoples, and particularly the Jews. Remember, the religion of Cyrus was not so terribly different from our religion. At heart, it was a religion of ethics, wouldn't you say?" "Yes, and I know that under Persian rule, Jerusalem prospered." "Oh, indeed, always. For hundreds of years, up until the time of the Romans, actually, when the rebellion started, and then the final defeat of Masada. We speak of these things to remind ourselves. At the time, I knew nothing of what was to come. But even I knew that Cyrus would keep his word, that he would send me on to Miletus. I trusted him from the first moment I ever laid eyes on him. He wasn't a liar. Well, not as much as most men." "But if he had his own wise men," I said, "why would he let something so powerful, I mean someone so powerful, as you slip from his grasp?" "He was eager to get rid of me," Azrael said. "And frankly, so were his wise men. He didn't let me slip from his grasp. Rather, he sent me to Zervan, the most powerful magus whom he knew. And Zervan was loyal to Cyrus. Zervan was rich and lived in Miletus, which had fallen to Cyrus and the Persians without even a skirmish, as Babylon had. Later on, of course, the Greeks of those Ionian cities, they would rise against the Persians. But at this time, when I stood there, glaring at the great king and begging that he send me to a powerful magician, Miletus was a thriving Greek city under Persian rule. He studied me. I started to ask another question, but he stopped me. "You went into the cold. You shouldn't have. You're warm now, and the fever has risen just a little. You need cold water. I'll get it for you. You drink it, and then we'll go on." He rose from the chair and went to the door. He brought a bottle from near the door. It was very cold indeed, I could see that, and I was thirsty. I looked down and saw that he was pouring the water into a silver cup. It wasn't an ancient silver cup. It seemed rather new, even. Machine-worked, perhaps. But it was beautiful, and of course it got cold all over with the water. It was like the Grail, or a chalice, or something a Babylonian would drink from. Or perhaps Solomon. There was another cup just like it in front of the chair. "How did you make the cups?" I asked. "Same as I make my garments. I call together all the particles that are required to come unobtrusively and without disturbance. I am not such a good designer of cups. If my father had designed these cups, they would be gorgeous. I merely told the particles that they were to make ornate cups of the style of this time. There are many, many more words to it than that, much more energy, but that is the gist." I nodded. I was grateful for the explanation. I drank all the water. He filled it again. I drank. The cup was solid enough, sterling. I studied it. It had a common Bacchanalian design to it, clustered grapes carved around the rim, and a simple pedestal foot. But it was very fine indeed. I was holding it in both my hands, lovingly, I suppose, admiring the fluted shape of it and the deep carving of the grapes, when I heard a faint sound emerge from it, and felt a tiny movement of air beneath my nostrils. I realized that my name was being written on the cup. It was in Hebrew. Jonathan Ben Isaac. The writing went all around and was small and perfect. I looked at him. He lay back in his chair with his eyes closed. He took a deep breath. "Memory is everything," he said softly under his breath. "Don't you think we can live with the idea that God is not perfect, as long as we are assured that God remembers everything?" "Knows everything, that's what you mean. We want him to forget our transgressions." "Yes, I suppose." He poured another cup of water for himself into his goblet, nameless but identical to mine, and he drank it. Again he rested, drifting, staring at the fire, his chest heaving. I wondered what it would be like to live in a world of figures such as his. Was that what Asa Gila had been like? Robed and bearded men dripping with gold ornament and shining with purpose. "Do you know," he asked me, smiling, "that the old Persians, they thought that, during the last millennia before the final resurrection, men would gradually turn away from the eating of meat and milk, and even plants, and that they would be sustained only on water, pure water. And then would come the resurrection. Yes, the bony world would rise. The valley of bones would come to life." He smiled. "So I think sometimes, when I want to comfort myself, that angels of might, demons of might, things such as me, that we are simply the last stage of humans, when humans can live on only water. So we are not unholy, we are simply very far advanced." I smiled. "There are those who believe our earthly bodies are only one biological stage, that spirits constitute another, that it's all a matter of atoms and particles, as you've said." "You pay attention to those people?" "Of course. I have no fear of death. I hope that my light will rejoin the light of God, but perhaps it won't. But I pay attention, lots of attention, to what others believe. This isn't an age of indifference, though it may seem so. Yes, I agree with you, he said. It's a practical, pragmatic time, when decency is the prime virtue. You know, decent clothes, decent shelter, decent food. Yes, I said. But it's also a time of great, luxurious spiritual thinking. Maybe the only time when such thinking carries no penalty. For after all, one can preach anything and not be dragged away in chains. There is no inquisition in the heart of anyone. No, there's an inquisition, alive in the hearts of all fundamentalists of all sects. But they don't, in most parts of the world, have the power to drag away the prophet or the blasphemer. That's what you've observed. Yes, he said. There was a pause. He sat up, obviously refreshed and willing to talk again. He turned slightly towards me, his left elbow back a bit, his arm outstretched on the arm of the chair. The gold on the blue velvet ran in loops and circles, which no doubt had a venerable history as a pattern, perhaps even a name. It was thick gold thread. It was twinkling in the light of the fire. He glanced at the tapes. I made the gesture that we were all ears, all of us, the tapes and me. Cyrus kept his word, he said with a shrug, to everyone. He kept his word to my father's family, to the Hebrews of Babylon. Those Hebrews that wanted to, and not all did, by the way, but those that wanted to went back to Zion and rebuilt the temple, and the Persians were never cruel to Palestine. Trouble came only centuries later with the Romans, as we've said. And you know, too, that many, many Jews stayed in Babylon, and they studied there and wrote the Talmud there. And Babylon was a place of great learning, until some horrible day in later centuries when it was burnt and then destroyed. But that came much later. I wanted to tell you first of the two masters who taught me everything that would be of use. I nodded. He let a silence fall, and I didn't disturb it. I looked into the fire, and for a moment I felt a dizziness, as if the pace of life, my heart, my breath, the world itself had gradually slowed. The fire was made of wood I hadn't brought here. The fire was full of cedar as well as oak and other wood. It was perfumed and crackling, and for a moment I thought again that perhaps I was dead, that this was some kind of mental stage. I could smell incense, and a feeling of ineffable happiness came over me. I knew I was sick. I had a pain in my chest and my throat, but these things were of no importance at all. I merely felt happy. What if I am dead, I thought. You're alive, he said in a soft, even voice. May the Lord God bless you and keep you. He was watching me. He said nothing. What is it, Azrael? I asked. Only that I like you, he said. Forgive me. I knew your books. I loved them. But I didn't know that I would like you. I foresee now what my existence is going to be. I see something of what God has planned, but never mind on that. We talk of the past, not God and the future. Part 2. Aesthetic Theory. A Poem from Some Lamb by Stan Rice, 1975. Contrive a poem out of ears. Tell it so that its petals unchocolate like a brain in a jar. Wax walnut, melting with thought. Make it a poem almost lewdly knowledgeable, and make its knowledge ooze, syrup from the punched trunk. Make it snake up to the molecule hoary and put its mouth atomic against the mouth of its core. Pull on its stem to expose its fetus.
Make it have children with sleek, ginger jaws. Make the dogs moan when it passes. Let it out of its jar. Make it lie with our corpse, our chaos. Make it hungry, evil, enemy of death. Put it on paper. Read it. Make surgery its sigh. And of such sting the scorpions call it Jehovah and who. Make it now before you crap out. Contrive it, sperm it, stroke it. Make it efficient. Make it fit. Make it more poem than poem can survive.
Chapter 9. Now I begin the story of my two masters and what they taught me. And I assure you that this will be the briefest part of my tale. I am eager to get on to the present. But I want this known and written down by you, if you will be so kind. So? Zervan announced himself to me dramatically. As I told you, I had gone into the bones. I was in darkness and sleep. There was an awareness in me, and there always is, but I can't express it in words, this awareness. Perhaps I'm like a tablet in my sleep upon which history is being written. But that image is too clumsy and concrete. I slept. I knew neither fear nor pain. I certainly didn't feel trapped. I didn't know what I was or where. Then Zervan called me. Azrael, servant of the bones, come to me, invisible, your Tselem only. Fly with all your might. I felt I had been sucked up into the sky. I flew towards the voice that called me, and as before I saw the air full of spirits, spirits in all directions, and spirits through which I moved with great determination, trying not to hurt them, yet deeply dismayed by their cries and the look of desperation in their faces. Some of these spirits even grabbed onto me and tried to stop me. But I had my command, and I threw them off with wondrous strength, which made me laugh and laugh. When I saw the city of Miletus below me, it was midday. The air was clearing of spirits as I neared the earth, or at least I was now moving at a different rate of speed and they weren't visible to me. Miletus lay on its peninsula, the first Ionic or Greek colonial city that I had ever beheld. It was beautiful and spacious, containing wondrous open areas and colonnades, and all the perfection of Greek art even at that early age. The agora, the palaestra, the temples, the amphitheater. It seemed all of it to be like a hand open to catch the summer breeze. And on three sides of it was the deep sea, filled with Greek and Phoenician and Egyptian merchant ships, and the harbor swarming with traders and with long lines of slaves in chains. The lower I dropped, the more I saw the beauty of it, which of course was not entirely unfamiliar to me in Babylon. But to see a city with so much splendid marble, to see it white and shining and not barricaded against the desert winds, that was the spectacle. It was a city where people went outdoors to talk and walk and gather and do the business of the day, and the heat was not unendurable, and the desert sands did not come. Into the house of Zervan I came immediately and found him sitting at his desk with a letter in his hand. He was Persian, maybe I should say Median, black-haired, though with plenty of gray on his head and in his beard, though not too old, and with large blue eyes that looked up at me at once, perceiving my invisible shape perfectly. And then he said, "Ah, make yourself flesh. You know how to do it. Do it now." This was exactly the tack to take, I guess, because I took great pride in calling for a body. And I didn't really know any words then other than what had been on the tablet. But I had the body made and well made within seconds. And he sat back laughing with delight, his knee up, looking at me. I suppose I looked as I do now. I remember being too astonished by this lovely Greek house with its courtyard and doors open everywhere, and paintings on the wall of slender, big-eyed Greek persons in sinewy, flowing garments that made me think of Egypt, but were definitely Ionic unto themselves. He put his foot down on the floor, turned his folded arms, and then stood up. He was dressed in the looser, more naked Greek manner of clothing, without fitted sleeves, as we always wore, and he wore sandals. He studied me fearlessly, as my father might have studied a piece of the silversmith's craft. "Where are your fingernails, spirit?" he asked. "Where is the hair on your face? Where are your eyelashes? Be quick. Hereafter you need only say, 'Bring to me all those details which I require at this moment, and nothing more. Fix an image, and you've finished your work. That's it. That's it.'" He clapped his hands. "Now you are plenty complete enough for what you have to do. Sit there. I want to see you move about, walk, talk, lift your arms. Go on, sit down." I did. It was a Greek chair, graceful with high arms and no back. Everywhere around me the light seemed glorious and different. Outside the clouds were piled higher. The air was clearer. "That's because you are on the shores of the sea," he said. "Do you feel the water in the air, spirit? That will always aid you. That is why the addle-headed ghosts of the dead and the demons like damp places. They need the water, the sound of it, the smell of it, the coolness creeping into them, in whatever form they possess." He made a long stroll about the room. Arrogantly, I just sat there, showing him no respect. He didn't seem to care. A Babylonian or Persian full suit would have been more flattering to him with his thin old legs and feet, but it was too warm. I drifted from looking at him. I was marveling at the mosaic floor. Our own floors at home had often been as colorful and as well crafted, but this floor was not full of stiff rosettes or processional figures, but with frolicking dancers and great clusters of grapes for ornament, and there was every kind of inlaid marble around its borders. The designs were fluid and jubilant. I thought of all the Greek vases I had handled in the marketplace, and how I had loved their graceful work. The murals on the walls were equally lovely and lively, and there were the repeated bands of color which utterly delighted my eye. He stopped in the middle of the room. "So we admire the beautiful, do we?" I didn't answer him. Then he said, "Speak, I want to hear your voice." "And what shall I say?" I answered, without rising. "What I want to say? Or what you tell me to say? What my true thoughts are, or some servile nonsense, that I am your spirit slave?" I broke off suddenly. I lost all confidence in myself. I realized I didn't know quite why I was saying these things. I struggled to remember. I had been sent to this man. This man was a great magician. This man was supposed to be a master of his craft. I was a servant. Who had made me that? "Don't make yourself dissolve with all this petty worry," he said. "You speak well and clearly, that's what I wanted to know. And you think. And you are most powerful. You are perhaps the greatest angel of might I've ever seen. And nothing I've ever conjured has had your strength." "Who sent me?" "It was a king," I said. "But my mind is muddled suddenly, and it's agony not to know." "It's the trap of spirits. It's what keeps them weak. It's the hobbling of them provided by God, you might say, so that they don't ever gain strength enough to hurt men and women too much. But you know who sent you. Think. Make yourself come up with the answer. You are going to start remembering things now. You are going to start paying attention. And first let go of the raging scream in you. I had nothing to do with those who hurt you and killed you. And I suspect there was much bungling to the whole affair, which a weaker spirit than you might never have overcome. But you did overcome it. and the man who sent you? He did as you asked him to do, remember? He did what you asked. Ah, yes, King Cyrus. He did send me to Miletus as I asked. It came clear, and it was all the more clear when I tried to let the anger pass from me like so much air out of my lungs. I even felt my lungs. I felt myself breathe. Don't waste your time on that, he said. Remember the questions I put to you? Your fingernails, your eyelashes, details that are visible. You need no inside organs. Your spirit fills up the perfect shell that you are, which no man can tell from a real man. Don't waste your strength making hearts for yourself, or blood, or lungs, just to feel human. That's stupid and foolish. Only now and then you'll need to make a little blood flow from your body. That's nothing. But don't go hungering after your human form. You're better now. Am I? I asked, still slouching in the chair, ankle on my knee, as this older, wiser man put up with my arrogance. Am I good, or am I something to do evil? You said angel of might. I heard the king use those words. But then he also said demon. Or was it someone else? He stood in the middle of the room, rocking a little, and composed, studying me through narrow eyes. I suspect you will be what you want, he said, though others may try to make you what they will. You have such hatred in you, Azrael, such hatred. You're right. I do hate. I see a boiling cauldron and I feel terror and then hate. Nobody's ever going to be able to hurt you like that again. And remember, you rose above the cauldron, did you not? Did you feel the scalding gold? I shuddered all over. I gave way to tears. I can't even stand to talk now of it, and I didn't want to talk to him. I felt it for an instant, I said. One instant I felt it, and what it would mean to remain in it and die in that pain. I felt it. I felt it piercing through some covering on me, some thick, numbing armor. But where it hurt me was my eyes. Ah, I see. Well, your eyes are fine now. I need the Canaanite tablet that brought you into being. I need the bones. You don't have them here? Hell no, he said. A pack of fools stole them. Desert bandits. They set upon Cyrus's party, slew them for every bit of gold they wore, and went off with the casket. They think the bones are solid gold. Only one Persian lived to reach the nearby village. Messages were sent. Now you have to go and find the bones and the tablet, the whole casket, and bring it to me. I can do this? Certainly. You came when I called you. Go back to that place, or to the place from which you came. See, this is the secret of magic, my son. Be specific. Say, I wish to return to the very place from which I came. That way, if the bandits have wandered 10 miles from where you were when you heard my summons, you'll apprehend them. Now, when you reach that place, remain corporeal and kill these thieves if you can. If you're not strong enough to do this, if they combat you with physical weapons which make you stagger, if they hurl charms at you that frighten you, and I warn you, there isn't a charm on earth that ought to frighten the servant of the bones, then become incorporeal. But take the bones with you. Gather them to yourself as though you were a funnel of desert wind. Gather them and bring them to me. I will deal with these thieves later. Go, bring the bones to me.
But you do prefer that I kill them?
Desert bandits? Yes, kill them all. Kill them easily with their own weapons. Don't bother with magic. It would be a waste of strength. Grab their swords and cut their heads off. You'll see their spirits for a moment. Shout at them to frighten them. Believe me, you won't have any trouble. Maybe that will soothe your pain. Go on, get the bones for me and the tablet. Hurry. I stood up. Do I have to tell you what to say? He prodded. Ask that you be returned to the place from which you came. and that all the articles of your present body wait at your beck and call to surround you and make you visible and strong when you reach the location of the bones. You'll love it. Hurry. I estimate this will take you until supper time. I will be dining when you get back. Can anything happen to me? You can let them frighten you so that you fail and I can laugh at you, he said with a shrug. Could they have powerful spirits? Desert bandits? Never. Look, you'll enjoy it. Oh, and I forgot to tell you. When you begin your return, of course, become invisible. They'll all be dead. You'll hold the casket tightly inside your spirit body, like so much wind surrounding it. I don't want you walking back here in a body with that casket. You have to learn to move things. If anyone sees you, ignore that person because you'll be gone from the sight of that being before he begins to make sense of what he's seen. Hurry. I rose to my feet, and with an immense roaring in my ears, I reappeared with the whole shell of the body in a small, thick desert house, where a group of Bedouins were gathered around a fire. At once they leapt to their feet and screamed at the sight of me and drew their swords. "You stole the bones, didn't you?" I said. "You killed the king's men." I had never felt such pleasure in all my human life. I had never felt such prowess or such utter freedom. I think I gnashed my teeth with happiness. I took a sword from one of them and hacked them all, every one, to pieces, easily cutting off the hands that tried to defend them, and slicing some heads from some bodies, and kicking their limbs about. I stared at the fire. I dropped the sword and I walked into the fire, and then back out of it. It didn't hurt this body, or its appearance of humanity. I gave out a roar that must have been heard in hell. I was hysterically happy. The place stank of blood and sweat. The death rattle came from one of them, and then he lay still. The door came open, two armed Bedouins flew at me, and I grabbed one of them and twisted his head off his neck. The other was now on his knees. But I killed him the same way too, easily. I could hear the noise of the camels outside and shouting. But the room was now empty of living beings, and I saw a great heap there covered by rude wool blankets. Throwing them back, I discovered the casket of my bones and looked inside. This, I have to admit, was not a pleasure. It broke the stride of my lusty killing. I looked and saw the bones, and then I sighed and thought, "Oh, well, you knew you were dead. So what?" There was much other treasure there, too, sacks of it. I gathered everything up into the blanket, clutched it with both arms, and said, "Leave me, particles of this body. Allow me to be invisible, swift and strong as the wind, and keep these precious articles safe in my arms, and take me to my master in Miletus, from whom I was sent." The great treasure was like an anchor, a stone, which made my travel slow but delicious. I felt the ascent with exquisite pleasure as I reached the clouds and then came down over the shimmering sea. I was so stunned by the beauty, I almost dropped everything. But then I got stern with myself and said, "Go to Zervan now, idiot. Return to the man who sent you now." I and the casket landed in the courtyard. Dusk. The sky was filled with a glorious, fresh-colored light. The clouds were tinged with it. I was lying there, in manly form, apparently simply by wishing it. And the treasure was there, the casket, now broken from my having crashed, and another box of letters thrown open. Out into the garden came my new master, who at once started to pick up the letters. "These miserable bastards, all this is from Cyrus to me. I hope you killed them." "With great joy," I said. I stood up, lifted the half-broken casket of the bones, and stood ready for any help he would need. He piled my arms with a few soft sacks that apparently held jewels. I wasn't sure. It felt like it. And that was all I'd brought with me, other than the casket and the letters. And he cast aside the blanket. To my utter amazement, the blanket just drifted off, as if wafted on a draft, and then went over the walls, snarling in the breeze, and disappeared. "Some poor hungry person will find it, and do something with it," he said. "Always remember the poor and the hungry when you cast aside what you don't want." "Do you really care about the poor and the hungry?" I asked. I followed him. We went back into the great room, which was now lighted by many oil lamps. I noticed for the first time shelves of tablets and lightly built wooden racks for the scrolls which the Greeks preferred. This had all been behind my back when I'd been slouching about before. I set down the broken casket on the floor and opened it. There were the bones, all right. He took the letters and the sacks of jewels to his desk, sat down, and at once began to read all the letters, quickly, leaning on his elbows, and only now and then reaching for a grape from a silver disc beside him. He opened the sacks, dumped out great clumps of jewelry, most of it looking Egyptian to me, some of it Greek, obviously, and then he went back to reading. "Ah," he said, "here is the Canaanite tablet with the ritual that created you. It's in four pieces, but I can put it together." He assembled the four pieces, and he made the tablet whole. I think I was relieved. I'd forgotten all about it. It had not been in the casket. It was small, thick, covered in tiny cuneiform writing, and seemed perfect, as if it had never been broken. He looked up suddenly, and then he said, "Don't just stand about. We need to work. Look, lay out all the bones in the form of a man." "I will not," I said. My wrath came up so hot I felt it even in this shell. It didn't make me melt, but it gave me a shimmer of heat which I could almost see. "I will not touch them." "All right, suit yourself. Sit down and be quiet. Think, try to think of everything you know. Use your mind, which is in your spirit and never was in your body." "If we destroy these bones, will I die?" I asked. "I said for you to think, not talk," he said. "No, you won't die. You can't die. Do you want to end up a tottering idiot of a spirit mumbling in the wind? You've seen them, haven't you? Or a stupefied angel roaming the fields trying to remember heavenly hymns? You're of this earth now, forever, and you might as well forget any bright ideas of simply dispatching the bones. The bones will keep you together, literally. The bones will give you a badly needed resting place. The bones will keep your spirit formed in a manner that will allow it to use its strength. Listen to what I'm telling you. Don't be a fool." "I'm not arguing with you," I said. "Have you finished reading the Canaanite tablet?" "Hush up." I sighed angrily and sat back. I looked at my fingernails. They were splendid. I felt my hair thick and the same. What was this like? Being alive in perfect health at a perfect moment of wakefulness and energy, untouched by hunger, fatigue, the remotest discomfort, a seemingly perfect physical statue. I smacked the floor with my slippered foot. I had on my favorite embroidered robes, naturally, and velvet slippers. The slipper made a good noise. Finally, he put all the tablets aside and said, "All right, since you were so reluctant to touch your own bones, finicky, cowardly young spirit, I'll do the work for you." He came to the center of the room. He dumped all the bones out on the floor. He stood back and he stretched out his hands, and then he lowered himself slowly, bending his knees. And out of his mouth came a long series of Persian incantations, murmurings. And I saw from his hands something coming forth, like heat, perhaps, from a fire, but nothing more visible than that. To my amazement, the bones assembled themselves in the form of a man laid out for burial. And now he continued his exhortations, and making a whipping gesture with his hand, as though sewing, he brought to him an immense spool of heavy wire, copper, or gold, or what, I couldn't tell. And now, with the gesture repeated over and over, he made the wire thread the entire skeleton together as if it were beads. He hooked bone to bone with this wire, without ever touching anything, merely making the motions. and he let his hands linger long over the hands and feet of the body, which had so many little bones. Then he moved to the ribs and the pelvis, and finally, with a long sweeping gesture of his right hand, he laid out the spine of this skeleton and connected it to the skull. He now had it all threaded together. One could have hung it from a hook to jangle in the wind. I saw a skeleton laid there as though in an open grave. I pushed aside all memory of the cauldron, of the pain, and I merely looked at it. Meantime, he had rushed into another room and now returned with two short little boys, boys about the age of 10, which I realized in an instant were not real, but spirits, barely corporeal. They carried with them another casket, smaller than the first, rectangular, smelling of cedar, yet heavily plated in gold and silver, and thick with jewels. He opened this casket. I saw a bed of folded silk. He told the little boys now to take this skeleton and to arrange it as if it were a child in its mother's womb, with its arms drawn up, and its head bent down, and its knees to its chin. The little ones obeyed these commands. They both stood up and looked at me with ink-black eyes. The bent-up skeleton just fit into the casket. It hadn't an inch to spare. "Go," he said to the little ones, "and wait for my next command." They didn't want to. "Go!" he roared. They ran from the room and stood peeping at me from the far door. I stood up and came towards the casket. It was like an old burial now, one found in the hills, from the ancient times when they buried men like this, in the womb of Mother Earth. I looked down at it. He was brooding. "Wax," he said, "I want a great deal of melted wax." He stood up and turned. At once I felt a shock of fear. "What's wrong with you?" he demanded. His two servants appeared again, eyeing me cautiously and carrying a big bucket of the melted wax. He took the kettle from them, for that's what it was, more or less, and he poured the wax all around the bones, so that as it hardened before my eyes it fixed them in place. It was a soft, white fixture for them. And then he told the little ones to go again, get rid of the kettle, and that they could play in the garden for an hour in their bodies if they didn't make noise. They were overjoyed. "Are they ghosts?" I asked. "They don't know," he said, still staring at the bones now fixed in wax. Obviously the question didn't interest him. He shut the casket. It had strong hinges and a strong lock. He tested this and opened it. "In time," he said, "though I won't wait too long, being as old as I am, I will make a tablet of silver to go with this, containing all that is needed from the Canaanite tablet. But for now the bones are as they should always be. Go into them and come back out." Naturally, I didn't want to do it. I felt a loathing for the bones, and a rebellious temper. But he waited me out like a wise teacher, and I did it, dissolving, feeling the smooth, calm darkness, and then being sucked out of it in a whirl of heat and finding myself standing beside him, embodied again. "Excellent," he said, "excellent. Now tell me all you remember of your life." Now that request on his part began one of the most unpleasant arguments of my entire immortal existence. I couldn't remember anything of my life. No matter how he badgered me, I couldn't remember. I knew I feared a cauldron. I knew I feared heat. I knew I feared bees, and the wax had made me think of them. I knew that I had seen Cyrus, king of Persia, and that the favor I had asked of him had not been unreasonable. Other than that, I knew only general things. Over and over he demanded I try. Over and over I failed. I wept. Finally I told him to leave me alone. What did he want of me? And he touched me on the shoulder and said, "There, there, don't you see? If you don't remember your life, you can't remember its moral lessons." "Well, what if there were none?" I said ominously. "What if all I saw was treachery and lies?" "That is simply impossible," he said. "But you do remember Cyrus, and you do remember what you did today?"
All that I could remember. Coming to him, all he'd said, being sent to slay the Bedouins and enjoying it, and coming back to him and all that had happened since. He threw at me a few random questions about details, such as what had the fire been made of round which the Bedouins camped? Camel dung was the answer. Had there been any women? No. Where was the place? I had to think and extract an answer, as I had taken no note. But it came to me to his satisfaction, 50 miles from where the desert begins due east of Miletus.
Who is king now?
Cyrus of Persia, I said. He then went into a whole series of questions. I answered them all. Who were the Lydians, the Medians, the Ionians? Where was Athens? Who was Pharaoh? What was the city where Cyrus had been declared king of the world? I answered and answered and answered. He asked practical questions about colors and food and air and warmth and heat. I knew all the answers. I knew everything general, but nothing pertaining to my own life. I knew lots about silver and gold and could tell him that. He was impressed. I looked at the emeralds the king had sent him, and told him they were most precious, and especially beautiful, and which was better than another. I told him the names of flowers in his garden. Then I felt tired. A strange thing happened. I began to weep. I began to weep like a child. I couldn't stop myself from it, and any sense of being humiliated before him didn't matter to me. Finally, I looked up and saw him waiting with his bright, curious, and rather merciless blue eyes. "Did you really mean it when you said, 'Always remember the hungry and the poor?'" I asked.
"Yes," he said. "I'm going to tell you the most important things I know now. Listen. I want this repeated back to me whenever I ask you for it."
"Very well."
"You call it the lessons of Zervan, and long after I'm dead, you demand of your masters that they tell you what they know. And you keep it in your memory even if it is something stupid, and you'll know when it's stupid. You are a clever, clever spirit."
"All right, bright blue-eyed master," I said angrily, "tell me all you know."
He furrowed his brows at the sarcasm and insult. He sat brooding. He put one knee over the other. He looked bony in his tunic. His gray hair came to his shoulders and there broke off, but his face was most alert. "Azrael," he said, "I could punish you for your impertinence. I could make you feel pain. I could pitch you into the cauldron you fear so that you do not know that it is not real. I can do that at any time. And if you do, I will climb out of that cauldron and I will rip you limb from limb, magician." "Yes, that's more or less why I haven't done it," he said. "So let me put it to you this way. I want and expect courtesy from you in return for all that I teach you. I am your master at your pleasure."
"Sounds all right," I said.
"All right. Now, this is what I know. Don't ever forget it. As long as you hate and you roast in a hell of anger, there will be a limit to what you can do. You will be at the mercy of other spirits now and then, and magicians. Anger is a confusing force, and hatred is blinding. So, you cripple yourself with this, you see, and that is why I would like to discipline it out of you, but that can't be done. But here are the lessons.